As usual on a Friday afternoon, the time 5:06, and it's time for Spectrum West. Hi, everybody. I'm Al Ross. Good to have you along today. We're going to today go back to an era that I hope finds new legs for the future, the era of the family resorts. We'll talk with Neil Johnson, who's put together an attractive book, Resorts of Wisconsin. I think you're going to like what you hear, and I'll bet it shakes some cobwebs loose in the memory bank. We'll learn about Stepping Stones of Dunn County, a group of services designed to assist the homeless, the hungry, and people who just need a lift. Catherine Dutton is here today. Jason Collins loves to play his saxophone, and he does so every chance he gets. Next Saturday, the Jason Collins Septet hits the stage of the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts in Menominee, and Jason will take us inside his world. Jim Oliver has a look at what's on stage in western Wisconsin, and we begin with our buddy, Jim Oliver. Yeah, you know, if that sounds familiar, if that sends a little tingle through your being, then Elvis Presley meant something to your life, and you remember. It's exactly the way it is with Jim's guest today.
O.C., Sleazy Rider. O.C., watch out.
George Thomas has performed as an Elvis Presley impersonator before audiences around the world, including Asia, South America, the Caribbean, and Canada, as well as in the United States. He has performed on television and in films and music videos. He opened his Elvis tribute show on Thursday at Fanny Hill Dinner Theater in Eau Claire. The show will continue tonight, Saturday and Sunday, and will carry on weekends and selected weekdays at Fanny Hill through March the 3rd. George Thomas is with us by telephone to talk about his career, his show, and, of course, Elvis. Welcome to Spectrum West.
Thank you, sir. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, Elvis Presley died in August of 1977. So how did you get interested in becoming an Elvis impersonator?
I was a fan of the music. I remember watching an Elvis movie when I was probably as young as 4 or 5 years old, and it had kind of an impression on me, but it wasn't until that day that he passed away. Everybody remembers where they were, and I'm no different. That was the day that my grandmother and my aunt were sobbing uncontrollably, and I couldn't understand why. And they gave me a very heartfelt description of his music and how he was as a person and how much he was loved and why. And gaining that background on him gave me some insight onto why they were so connected to him emotionally after he died. And then it grew on me. I became more and more of a fan, and I bought my first Elvis record collection when I was 12 years old and absorbed all that music. And another reason was because I liked what I was hearing, and my father was so strict he wouldn't really allow me to listen to much else, but Elvis was acceptable in the household. And so I just gravitated towards it and absorbed it, and that was my education. I was basically, you know, self-taught. An opportunity came along, you know, many years later for me to enter an Elvis contest, and I thought it was a little silly because I wasn't a big fan of impersonators, and I'm not a big fan of that word either. I think of myself as a fan who's paying tribute and doing an honorable and respectful, you know, tribute to Elvis, just honoring his legacy and his memory. And I want to do it with good taste and just capture glimpses and moments in front of an audience so they can remember flashes of what he was about. And if I can bring that to life, then I've done my job and I'm happy.
Now, do you consider yourself more of an actor or as a musician?
I would say I'm definitely more of an actor/entertainer. Mm-hmm. I'm definitely a front man and an entertainer who really cares about the audience, and I love to involve the audience and make the show all about them, and I want to see the joy in people's eyes when we take them down memory lane, so to speak, and they can relive the magic and the music, and I take them back to a different place in their life when people remember moments when they were younger and life was simpler, and Elvis encompasses all that. All the good times, you know, just the sound of his voice makes people feel good, brings a smile to their face. So I feel very fortunate I can do that.
When did you give your first performance as Elvis? Do you remember your first performance?
Yeah, it was, I sang Are You Lonesome Tonight one day over lunch. I was with a group of people. It was on a movie set. I was feeling kind of rambunctious that day, I guess, and I started singing the song just to sort of snap the silence. And this girl turned and looked at me and said, you know, I just heard about some Elvis contest going on down the street at a local bar. You should enter. And I was kind of against the idea, thinking I didn't think I had the goods. But she was very persistent, and she just would not take no for an answer. So her and her boyfriend, who was a rockabilly guitarist, took me to the club. I entered the contest, had nothing but jeans and a jean jacket to wear. I ended up winning the contest, and I won another one a few weeks later. It was like Elvis season. It was December and January when Elvis's birthday is in January, so there was a multiple contests going on. I happened to win both, and then I started getting phone calls from gentlemen who got my phone number from the owner of the nightclub where the contest was taking place, and he recommended me as his first choice to pass on to people for their private home parties, their wedding anniversaries, their wives' birthdays, and so on. And a year later, I was on the Joan Rivers show in New York doing a live-to-tape morning interview. It just kind of snowballed from there into a lot of work worldwide.
Well, talk a little bit about how your show is presented.
We break the show down to three acts, and we start off in the early 50s when he was, you know, the king of rock and roll and then the hip-swiveling threat to society. And we cover songs like Blue Suede Shoes and Hound Dog and with all the high-energy moves that go with it and the gold jacket. After the first intermission, we go into the second phase, which is the Black Leather 1968 comeback concert. Elvis really covered a lot of his hits in that special. We go over some of the hit songs, plus we throw in a few surprises. We have one more intermission break at that point. The audience can then expect to see me coming out in the white Aloha jumpsuit, which is a replication of that satellite concert Elvis did in 1973 live in front of 1.5 billion viewers. We perform a lot of the greatest hits from that era as well in the white jumpsuit.
He is George Thomas, whose Elvis Presley tribute show will be performed at Fannie Hill Dinner Theater in Eau Claire. I remember seeing a video of one of Elvis's last performances, and he really didn't look very good. Do you try to capture how he looked through his life?
Well, I try to give people glimpses of Elvis. I'd like people to remember him when he was at his best. And, of course, I remember that concert. It was his last televised concert on CBS in June of 77. He just was losing the battle. You could see it in his eyes. And I think he knew he was going. He always took such pride in his appearance, but he was so bloated, and it was mostly in his face and, of course, around the midsection. But his voice never left him. The magic gift that he had never really left him. He just didn't quite have the same spark. But the boyish charm was also still there. You know, he was very self-effacing. And when I cover the jumpsuit years, I don't have that look, I mean, as far as him looking unhealthy, but I want to capture the best moments of the jumpsuit years, and we do that in the third set, Suspicious Minds and Burning Love and In the Ghetto. And we're also open to taking audience requests, so anything the audience throws at us, we're happy to try and give them exactly what they're asking for.
Now, some of the advanced information that has been put out about it says you do kind of a different show every night. It's audience interactive. Talk about how that works, you're changing the show depending upon your audience.
Yeah, you know, if we get a really lively group that's very boisterous, then I like to bring people up on stage, you know. I'll bring gentlemen up for Jailhouse Rock in some cases if they're open to it and they want to get up and maybe get out of their chairs and dance a little bit. Have them do a little simple, you know, Elvis move with me, and I recreate the Jailhouse Rock sequence as in the film when Elvis had male dancers behind him as part of that choreography. Any gentleman who have the chutzpah to do that, their wives love it. They love to take a photo of that, and it just creates memories. It's all about creating a great experience, and people have to walk away with great memories of a fun show that they not only could be viewers of, but they also have the option, if they feel so inclined, to get up and become part of the show. And we love to facilitate that. I'll go into the audience and sing to the ladies and do what Elvis did and Love Me Tender and Are You Lonesome Tonight? Can't Help Falling in Love. Look him in the eyes, and I love the music, and the words tell their own story. And when you connect with an audience like that, there's just no better feeling, not only for myself, but for the folks that are in the audience, too. I plan on doing a meet and greet after every performance in the lobby of the theater so I can shake hands, you know, say hello to people, have a few fun words of conversation, take photos, and absolutely, it's all about that. You know, I'm happy to do it.
This is probably the hardest question I'm going to ask you, but what are your favorite Elvis songs?
It's a tough question because there's so many great songs. I love Jailhouse Rock, and I like songs like Trouble from the King Creole movie soundtrack. If you're looking for trouble, you came to the right place. If you're looking for trouble, just look right at my face. You know, it's a very fun song with a lot of energy behind it. And I love Suspicious Minds in the later jumpsuit years, and I love Can't Help Falling in Love. Hound Dog is very high energy. And, you know, there's also a lot of obscure, great movie songs that we're going to definitely cover during this run. and do songs that maybe people love and are personal favorites, but they don't get an opportunity to hear very often because people stick to the tried and true regulars, and I definitely plan on doing that. But in addition to those, there's a lot of great lesser-known songs that are known by real Elvis fans but are not performed, and we want to sort of cover that territory as well.
Talk a little bit about the backup music that you have.
The band?
Yeah. Do you play guitar yourself?
I strum about three chords. I'm not a huge guitar player at all. You know, for me, it's more about it's for the look of what Elvis had, and I strum a few chords. But my act is so physical and so much movement that sometimes having a guitar strapped around your neck, it banging against the mic stand, you know, it becomes a little cluttery for me. So I tend to just use the guitar minimally and then make the show more performance-oriented. But fortunately, I'm backed by three very, very talented musicians who are really passionate about the music as well, and they're doing a great job, and it's going to have a great live full sound like a real concert in a more intimate setting.
What kind of preparation do you have to do just in general for doing the act that you do?
I like to listen to some of Elvis' tunes beforehand to put me in the space, but I've done it for so long that it's really a part of me. It kind of lives inside of me. It breathes inside of me. I love the music. Like I said, I was basically grew up on it and absorbed it. And it might have at times, you know, not been at the forefront of my mind as much. But shows like this definitely bring out the absolute best in me. And my love definitely shines through for Elvis and his music. Just getting in that zone before a show really just takes hearing the music and just going back in my mind to that place of when I first saw Elvis in a movie or in a concert that gave me a certain thrill and excitement watching his dynamic style, that it kind of puts me in that place and gets me ready for a show.
Well, we've been visiting with George Thomas, whose tribute to Elvis Presley, the King of Rock and Roll, opened on Thursday and will continue weekends and selected weekdays through March 3rd at Fanny Hill Dinner Theater in Eau Claire. For ticket information, you can go online to the Fanny Hill website at www.fannyhill.com. George Thomas, thanks so much for being with us.
Sir, it's been such a pleasure. It's been an honor speaking with you. Thank you for everything. And I really look forward to meeting all the great folks here in Eau Claire and anywhere else they want to come from, whether it's Minneapolis, or I want to meet as many of the folks out in this area as possible. And I want to give them exactly what they would like to see.
Support for WPR comes from Wisconsin Credit Union, announcing a new location in Eau Claire at the corner of Claremont Avenue and Craig Road. Complete information, including membership and loan applications, is at wisconsincu.org. Support also comes from Festival Foods, dedicated to making every business decision based on the premise of bringing customers back. More about Festival Foods' boomerang theory at festivalfoods.com.
Spectrum West at 19 minutes after 5 o'clock. I'm Al Ross. Thanks for being with us today. Cabaret 35 School Day continues at UW Eau Claire as a Spectrum memo for you. Performances are tonight at 7:30 and tomorrow at 2 p.m. Tickets at the Service Center and by phone at 836-3727 or toll free at 800-949-UWEC. Tomorrow, the Saturday Artist Talk Series continues at the Abode Gallery in Stockholm featuring studio potter S.C. Rolf. Admission is free. They all start at 2:30. Well, this is the second week we've chosen to visit Menominee for a Spectrum West segment. Last week, talking with a UW Stout mentor of a student-run health clinic that serves Dunn County residents from the Stepping Stones Food Pantry. This week, we're going to learn about Stepping Stones itself within a conversation enjoyed with Catherine Dutton, Stepping Stones Executive Director. Here is that dialogue. Last week, in talking about the student-run health clinic, we usually referred to Stepping Stones as a food pantry, but I understand it's much more than that. Tell us about the history behind Stepping Stones, if you would, please.
Sure. Stepping Stones began actually as an organization to help seniors get rides to medical appointments. It started with a group of individuals who knew there was a need in the community and got that organized. And that program is now called our Community Connections Program. And we link volunteers up to provide all kinds of services for people in need in the community. The second program that was added is our homeless shelter. We offer services for homelessness prevention and people who are homeless and need housing. And then it was sometime after that that the food pantry was added. So although that's the largest program we do, it was actually the third one that became part of the organization.
Uh-huh. The mantra that appears on your website reads, "Stepping Stones seeks to foster a community that prevents hunger, homelessness, and isolation throughout Dunn County." That's nicely said.
Thanks.
How about your personal history with it?
I've been at Stepping Stones for about 4 years, and prior to this, I worked at Second Harvest Heartland Food Bank in St. Paul, so that was a good transition for me here. And I've always had a career in nonprofits, so to be able to work at Stepping Stones has been a great fit, and I think our mission of helping people through the community has been really important to me, and I'm glad to be part of it.
People tend to look around at their surroundings, and when one does that in Menominee and the area, one might not immediately see the need for your services. Tell us about the need for who you are there.
Dunn County is actually one of the top 15 poorest counties in the state out of 70-some counties. So although it might not be readily apparent when you drive down the streets, that's the statistical reality of it. So that may be because it's largely a rural county, but also just because of the unemployment. So the needs are very great. The numbers that have been growing consistently since I've been here and prior to that as well, the number of visits to our food pantry, we average about 1,300 visits per month. That's household visits, and each household represents about 3 people is the average size. That's a lot of people who are needing food assistance in Dunn County.
Yeah. I think it's often surprising, sadly surprising, people how many years ago did not even consider homelessness as a problem, but it doesn't matter the size of a metro area. It's there.
Right. People are often, they become homeless for many reasons. It can be because of the economy and that they can't afford rent anymore, or it can be because of family situations and people being divorced or domestic violence or just not being able to be together in a household.
Sure.
So there's many reasons.
The topic is Stepping Stones of Dunn County. Our guest executive director, Catherine Dutton, on Spectrum West today. We keep hearing about funding being cut for so many of what some call entitlements, and others take it a step further in calling it other things. But how are you doing in the support department, and what are your sources?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's true that funding is cut, especially government funding, federal and state. We do receive local government support that's really helpful. And other sources of funding we have, we're over 50% of our revenue is from individual gifts and contributions, individual people from churches and from businesses and other organizations that know about the need in the community and want to be supportive. And then we also receive some grants from private foundations, and we do some fundraising.
Hopefully that all continues and even grows
in
the future. A wise person once said, "It takes a village." Let's allow you for a moment to brag a bit about the wonderful colleagues and volunteers that I know you must have there.
Sure. It does take a village to support a community, too. So we have a small staff, and we keep it small so that we can put more of our funding into programs and to helping the people who need assistance. But we have a great volunteer base. We have probably close to 200 regularly active volunteers who are doing something usually at least once a week. We have regular volunteers who help in the food pantry to stock shelves or help do client intake, help with unloading trucks, delivering food, all kinds of things. Then we also have volunteers who go out into the community to help with transportation needs or help someone get to a medical appointment, to the grocery store, shoveling, that kind of thing. So great diversity that way. We have a group that helps build ramps for people with disabilities who need a wheelchair ramp.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a lot of diversity, and we couldn't do a fraction of what we do if we didn't have such great volunteers.
Yeah, I'll bet. How can people help you help others? Are you in need of volunteers or certain items or categories of items that you might want to publicize?
Sure, thanks. We always kind of have ongoing needs that are pretty consistent. We don't have a huge shortage of volunteers, but there's always turnover, so we're always happy to have new volunteers and are able to find places to plug people in, and that's great. And then food and funds are our other consistent needs. We can do a lot more with financial donations in terms of stretching them to purchase food. We use the Feed My People Food Bank in Eau Claire, and we can get 10 times the amount of food there per dollar than if we had to buy it retail. But food drives are also great because we get a good diversity of items that way, more selection for people who come. So we're happy for those things, too. And pretty much any kind of shelf-stable food is great. We do accept fresh produce. We can't take meat or frozen items unless it comes directly from a food retailer. It's a food safety issue.
Well, there, but for the grace of God, go I. Let's say I need the services of Stepping Stones. How do I contact you?
Sure. Our phone number is 715-235-2920. We're at 1602 Stout Road, right next to the fairgrounds in Menominee. And we're open every day. People can call for our pantry hours. We're open for the food pantry 3 hours a day, weekdays, and 2 hours on Saturdays, so 6 days a week. And people don't need to prove their income. We do ask what it is, but if someone comes and needs food, then they receive it.
And you have a website?
We do. That's www.steppingstonesdcfordunncounty.org.
Well, thank you very much for all that information. Thanks for taking time with us, and keep up the great work at Stepping Stones, Catherine Dutton.
Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
And if you have time or you have the resources, that is one of the fine grassroots efforts to help your neighbor. You can help lay down even more stepping stones so those who need help can go even further. Again, the phone number is 715-235-2920. And the website, again, is steppingstonesdc.org. Spectrum West salutes you, Stepping Stones. Tomorrow's the 14th annual Locopalooza show choir competition at Altoona High School. 16 show choirs from Wisconsin and Minnesota will participate. It begins at 7:40 a.m. Wow, and goes all day and into the evening. You can get tickets at the door. Area vocalists are invited to join the Red Cedar Choir, beginning spring semester rehearsals next Thursday, January 31st, 7 p.m., Fine Arts Music Room, UW Barron County in Rice Lake. No audition. Just show up. Have a good time. Well, Jason Collins does a lot of things. He's a middle school language arts teacher. He's a dad. And then there's the music, his love of and participation in the music. The Jason Collins Septet will grace the stage of the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts next Saturday, and he has a few gigs with other groups before and after next Saturday as well. Jason has been here before, but not often, simply because he's so dang busy. When I looked at your MySpace account and then I listened to your music, I decided that the best word to describe Jason Collins is busy. Your schedule is busy. And I determined after listening to more of it that your music is busy. Let's tackle the music part of that equation first. Talk about your background. Take us back and tell us when and how the music bug hit you.
Well, the music bug hit me in high school. I played saxophone in middle school just because that was what you did. But I played guitar. Started taking guitar lessons, and one of the first things my guitar teacher did was say, you need to go listen to these tapes. And he said, listen to Spyro Gyra, the Blues Brothers soundtrack. And so I got the Spyro Gyra tape, and I purchased the Blues Brothers soundtrack, and I heard the alto saxophone on both those, and I went, wait, what's that? I stopped taking guitar lessons and started taking saxophone lessons because it was that sound. I just was like, that's what I wanted, that's what I liked, and never knowing that the saxophone could do that. And I immediately went to my band director and said, what is this, and how do I do this, and got to start taking lessons, and found out there was actually a jazz band. I didn't even know there was a jazz band at our school, and
wow.
Got involved in the jazz band, got to play Barry Sax because they needed a baritone sax, and kind of went from there. And then quickly it evolved from Cyber Gyra to Cannonball Adderley and John Coltrane and Charlie Parker, and it just exploded.
Did you get into writing it as well?
No, I didn't get into writing music until about 10 years ago. I studied in college. I studied language arts in college, but I always played music in college and studied saxophone privately in college and after college. And I would go hear musicians play. I would hear them play the standards and hear them play a Charlie Parker tune, and I'm thinking, I don't want to go hear that. I want to hear something new and original. And I thought, well, if that's what I want, I got to start doing that myself.
Yeah.
So I started trying to write and would bug people about how to write and does this work and not work and just kind of go from there.
How tough was it to start writing? I mean, you just said that you had some mentors, you asked some people, but I mean, you knew what you liked. Did you tend to write what you liked, or did you tend to say, yeah, you know, I can hear that from somebody else. Let's go here.
That's a good question. I should have done that, but no, when I started writing, I definitely was modeling exactly what was being done. So this is Art Blakey. What are they doing? Specifically with how are they arranging their horns? Because I love the three-horn line, alto, tenor, trumpet. So how are the harmonies put together? And just started, you know, just asking people about that and studying the written music and how things worked and starting very simply with a blues tune or with a rhythm changes tune. And then starting to evolve from there and hearing different composers and different writers and musicians and going, what's happening there? And trying to model from it and realizing I take an idea and it pretty quickly would evolve into something that was in my head that became different, but it was a jumping point for them or from them.
Well, as I said, your music, at least what I've been able to hear, is busy. That's a positive term. and there's a lot going on. Even if it's a slow song, there are a lot of parts. People involved in the playing of the music seem to be going in different directions, but they all seem to be still going down the same road. So are there different categories of jazz? What are the categories in which you like to reside?
Yeah, I think there are definitely different categories of jazz. I mean, I definitely come from what I call, I don't know if it's an appropriate term, but like the 50s blue note sound, which is Horace Silver, Art Blakey, Lou Donaldson, which is kind of rooted in the blues. But I've very been influenced recently by a lot of modern composers like Avishai Cohen, the bass player, Ben Allison. They're taking music and it's hard to explain what they're doing, but they're opening it up and they're doing more motifs and themes that kind of layer on top of each other.
Okay.
Dave Holland, another bass player, does that. Miles Davis on the Silent Way Sessions does that. Where you take a theme and you kind of build, so everybody has a part. So that's why I think you get the busyness. Everybody's got some specific line to layer this theme and these cadences together.
I almost likened it to singing. You know, remember when you were a kid and you sang what was called a round?
Yes.
And you just tried not to listen to what the other person was doing.
Yeah, sometimes you have to. It's hard. Yeah, sometimes you have to just kind of stick to your thing and it'll come together. Like there's one tune I wrote where the bass is playing in 5/4 and the drums is playing in 3/4. It works mathematically because 5 and 3 have the common number of 15, so every 15 beats they're all together again.
Ooh.
When I play that tune, I cannot listen to the bass at all. I have to it's hard.
They're just a whole bunch of solo instruments playing their thing.
Very much so, very much so. And that's because the band I have that I get to have play with me, everybody in that band is top-notch, phenomenal players.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to give them as much freedom and chance to play as I can.
The band he just alluded to is the Jason Collins Septet, and we are speaking with Jason Collins today on Spectrum West. They're appearing at the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts next Saturday. It's the 2nd of February. Well, that's the musical busyness of Jason Collins. Let's get to the regular busy. You hold down a regular job to put food on the table. Music buys the dessert, I would guess.
Yes, it buys the reeds. Yeah.
Well, you play in all different kinds of configurations, trios, quartets, the septet, I'll bet you everything in between there, the Chippewa Valley Jazz Orchestra. You play with Sue Orfield every once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
Is that all part of paying the kinds of dues that one must pay to succeed in the music business, do you think, or is that just your life?
It's just fun. I don't see it as paying dues. It's just joy. Okay. I love playing. I love interacting with other musicians and seeing what happens. It's a blessing to be able to be a part of those groups.
Uh-huh. So you're really not busting your chops just to succeed at something. You're just doing it because it's fun. And then I was going to say, well, you know, what really is the definition of success in the music business anyway? It's just having fun when you play, I guess.
Yeah, I think so. And it's also with music, the more you play, the better you're going to get. And the more you play with people, the better you're going to get. So every chance I can, I want to play and interact with other people.
So there's a young person out there just sort of floating around saying, oh, I love music, but I don't know what to do. What kind of advice would you have for a person like that? You got lucky. You had an epiphany.
Yeah, I did. I would try to provide that epiphany for them. I would just throw at them as many different sounds of the instrument they're playing. And it's amazing now with technology these days. I used to make CDs for kids and say, oh, you play the trumpet. Here, I made a CD. There's all these different trumpet players. See, there's something you like.
Ah.
And now you can just give them a list of names and they can find those musicians and music so quickly. So I'm just trying to throw out as many different names and sounds and ideas to students as I can that show that interest in music.
So that's an idea of what makes Jason Collins tick. I think it's time to listen to something from the septet that will be entertaining you next Saturday in Menominee. Jason provides the background to an original song.
Well, this is recorded at my last gig I had, the Mabel Tainter, a couple years ago. It came from that line. It's an 8-beat line. I wrote it with 3-3-2, but it's really an 8-beat song. And I had that line in my head, and I wanted to do something with that, and I wanted to keep it simple, so it was just that line repeated over and over again. So there's no real chord changes, and then I put another line on top of it that the bass player plays, and I just wanted to explore that little piece of music and see what could happen with it. And I also knew that I had Dean Granrose playing guitar with me, and Dean can take anything and explode. And I wanted to give that as a vehicle for Dean.
I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you, what's a Nornelia?
Ah, good question. My son, I have a 6-year-old son who loves planets. He loves them. We put them in his ceiling. We hung them with those little white balls. And
sure.
He knows them all backwards and forwards, knew the names of the moons on the planets. And my brother asked my son, Owen, well, what's the name of our moon? Because all the other planets have names of moons. My son said, well, we should call it Nornelia.
Just picked it out of space, that name.
He did, yeah, Nornelia.
Let's enjoy a bit of Nornelia. The Jason Collins Septet, live at the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts in Menominee next Saturday, February 2nd. Tickets at mabeltainter.org. Tonight, by the way, at the Tainter, it's the Dance and Percussion Ensemble, Buckets and Tap Shoes. And tomorrow evening, it's Bluegrass with the Barley Jacks. Both begin at 7:30. Mabel is busy, and that's music to our ears.
Here's what's on stage this weekend and beyond at Western Wisconsin theater venues. The Old Gem Theater in New Richmond will have public performances of Stone Soup at 10:30 a.m. Saturday and 2 p.m. Sunday. The production, aimed at students in pre-kindergarten through third grade, will also play weekdays through February 22nd. The Eau Claire Children's Theater production of Secret Garden will play next Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the State Theater in Eau Claire. The Children's Theater's interactive dinner theater production, Murder at the Class Reunion, will play tonight and Saturday at the Oxford Theater in Eau Claire. Reservations were required a week in advance, so if you don't have a ticket, you could be out of luck. Elvis, The Essence of the King, plays tonight, Saturday, and Sunday, and selected weekdays at the Fannie Hill Dinner Theater in Eau Claire. The show runs through March 3rd. The Baron Spotlighter's production of Frost Nixon plays tonight and Saturday, and next Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Baron Area Community Center. The Rainmaker will play tonight, Saturday, and Sunday in the Black Box Theater of the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson. And the Fannie Hill Dinner Theater will hold auditions for five upcoming shows from 4:30 p.m. until 7:30 p.m. on Monday. Roles are available for A Weekend Comedy, Don't Dress for Dinner, Bingo the Musical, Barefoot in the Park, and Carol of a Christmas. And that's some of what's happening in live theater around the region. I'm Jim Oliver.
Spectrum Memos this afternoon, Frostbite Follies featuring roots music, ragtime piano, slapstick humor, aerialists, food juggling, and more. That's foot juggling, not food. See, I was thinking food juggling when I wrote that, and I thought, wouldn't that be cool if you could juggle your food? Well, I think you can. And some people do, I'm sure. Starring Pop Wagner and Butch Thompson tomorrow at the Phipps in Hudson, two shows at 2 and 7 p.m. Series of exhibitions featuring mixed media, printmaking, oil paintings, ceramics, acrylics, journal drawings, and watercolors. And a group exhibition by 11 local artists is up at the Phipps through February 10th in the galleries there. Go to thephipps.org, and that is where you get all the information you need. The exhibit Design with Intent, Five Decades of Design for Communication, is up through February 14th. That's in the Foster Gallery of the Haas Fine Arts Center at UW-Eau Claire. What else can we tell you? Congratulations, by the way, to the winners in the concerto competition as presented by the Chippewa Valley Youth Symphony. We talked about it last week. Third place went to Melanie Hansen on clarinet, Simon Lohman on trombone, and Eva Peterson on violin tied for second place. And this year's winner is Hannah Gilberstadt, who plays the flute. Hannah will be featured with the Youth Symphony on May 19th. That's pretty cool. Congratulations, all of them. At the Heide Center in Chippewa Falls, last chance to see the work of Al Harper, who sculpts in cottonwood bark, and Gary McMahon, whose medium is titanium. A new exhibit opens next Friday. Also, next Friday, the Chicago-based performance ensemble Gigarte Capoeira dances, sings, and plays. We're going to learn more about the Brazilian-flavored ensemble on next week's program. All the details for the Heide is at 726-9000. That's the phone number, and it's cvca.net. Well, you know, usually our good friend and correspondent for special events, Jim Oliver, handles most things literary in nature here on the program. But when I heard about this book, I selfishly grabbed it and ran, simply because of the warm glow that came over me when I read about it. It's called Resorts of Wisconsin, Exploring the Heritage and History of Wisconsin's Family Resort. And it's because I have memories of such a place, and I wanted to rub elbows with someone who had similar respect for the experience. We'll get to that interview in just one moment.
Support for WPR comes from Ken Vance Hyundai, featuring the new 2013 Hyundai Elantra, now equipped with a 1.8-liter engine and 6-speed transmission with Shifttronic and active ecosystem for fuel economy. More at kenvance.com. Support also comes from Wisconsin Credit Union, offering online and phone loan applications for student loans, consolidation, vehicles, a line of credit, and more. Information is online at wisconsincu.org.
I talked about rubbing elbows. The elbows I was talking about belong to Neil Johnson, who, along with Adam Swenson and photographer Jim Backus, the non-Thurston Howell and un-Magoo Jim Backus, compiled this book. Neil Johnson lives in Hibbing, Minnesota, but has roots to West and to Northwest Wisconsin. Let's hear about it. I was a kid who grew up going to a resort with not only my family, but we would meet my cousin's family, and we would spend a week at a place called Maywood Lodge in Lac des Flambeaux. It had a lodge, and then it had probably five or six cabins. The lake was just pristine. In the lodge, you could eat. You could also play bunco on, like, Wednesday nights. And then there was another smaller log cabin that was the resort's own tavern. Split log bar, and oh man, we used to spend time in there drinking orange pop, playing love letters in the sand on the on the jukebox. Yeah, it was cool.
Yeah, it's amazing how resorts, for those that it was a part of their childhood, it becomes such a big part of their life. The friendships that they make, and some of those people have been going to those same resorts 50, 60 years, family groups that continue to go over and over again, and they always have the same cabin. They consider it.
Oh, yeah.
They own the cabin.
Exactly.
And then the people in the next cabin have been going there the same amount of time, and everybody knows everybody.
Yep.
And you wouldn't even believe all the marriages that have happened out of resort.
Well, that's good stuff. Well, I'm guessing that in order to do the topic justice, you must have, first, a reverence for what it is you're featuring. Tell me about that, and what other than being a good writer and editor qualifies you to do a book about such a respected heritage?
I grew up in northern Minnesota on the lakes, and I love that. That outdoor lifestyle. As a child, I never actually went to resorts. The first time I went to a resort was my first year of marriage. I took my wife. We thoroughly enjoyed it. I think for people to be able to unplug, disconnect with our highly connected world, and spend time together and build those familial relationships is so important. That's why I love the subject. And one of the other themes that I carried through that book, and we did a special write-up on, was just getting kids out in nature. I mean, the whole concrete jungle, and then they just go from building to building. They play the video games, they do whatever. Mm-hmm. That connection with nature and that ability to see the natural life and process is so important.
It's kind of too bad that many resorts, some of them I'm thinking Wisconsin Dells specifically.
I did history on the Wisconsin Dells. You'll notice there's no specific resort featured out of a modern, with modern day pictures and such. But you go back in the history of the Dells, and it really was. It was the family-owned, family-run property. That's what made it. But eventually, of course, the water park hotels took over. And I'll be frank, I mean, I've gone to a water park hotel with my kids, and it's fun. But it's, for me, it's an overnight, or it's a couple nights, and then we're gone. When we want to spend treasure time together, we get out into the woods.
Sure, but it's got to be tougher, though, as a resort owner nowadays, to consider all the things you feel as if you need to do to compete with other places. Whereas back in the day, the resorts, all they had to have was some cabins that were there and some water.
That's right. The thing about the water park hotel industry, if you take a look at that growth curve, it was unbelievable. Over 10 years.
Even resorts on water feel as if they have to have a room that has all the games in it, the video games.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. And all the Wi-Fi and the plasma TVs. And you know, and I think if that's my whole point of going to a resort is to get away from that stuff.
Exactly. And even back when I was a kid, when we had one television and one telephone, it was still a relief for my parents to go on vacation. They got away from them, and we are a million times more exposed.
Yeah.
What, didn't you have connections to northern Northwest Wisconsin at the same time when you were a kid? Didn't you
absolutely
spend some time over there?
My family was one of the original three families to settle the Sorona, Wisconsin area. I spent a lot of time in Northwest Wisconsin as a kid. My Uncle Bob had a cabin on the shores of Long Lake by Birchwood, and he used to make homemade root beer. I have a lot of fond memories of sitting on his porch sipping homemade root beer as a kid and enjoying Cumberland, Shell Lake, Birchwood, Rice Lake, Spooner. Those towns were a big part of my youth. And, of course, Camp Eatmore was the family deer camp.
Love that name, by the way.
Yeah. Well, it was named Eatmore because there was a guy who was a chef who would always come to camp. He didn't hunt, but he always cooked for the camp. Good times in Northwest Wisconsin. It's beautiful. You know, the two states, there's always that little bit of rivalry, but
yep.
I enjoyed both states. My family is Packer fans because my dad and that heritage, but we're Twins fans. And you see a lot of that, too, in Minnesota, where you have people or transplants from Wisconsin. And the Packers are just, you can't leave the Packers.
Yeah, it's best not to leave the Packers, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
You know. Neil Johnson, our guest on Spectrum West. We're talking about the book Resorts of Wisconsin. He wrote it with a guy named Adam Swenson. There you go, Johnson Swenson. Must have been a lot of Lefse consumed when they were when they were writing the book. Tell me, Neil, about researching the book. I once spent a week on the road visiting golf courses in Wisconsin, and I did not want that week to end. It kind of sounds like one of the best jobs I can think of.
Oh, it was fun times for both books. I did Resorts of Minnesota first and then Resorts of Wisconsin as a follow-up. And the individual resort stories were written by Adam, and then the historical overviews, the pieces on muskies and gangsters, I did all of those. But Adam was my editor on the first book, and we just really developed a good relationship with him, and he really wanted to be more involved, and I wanted to shoot more photos in this book. So first, I do some online research, try and find ones that I think are interesting, that would have an interesting story, that are family-owned, family-run. That's one of the big things throughout this book. It's not corporate properties.
Mm-hmm.
Not that there's anything wrong with those, but I don't think that's the missing story. Those stories have been told oftentimes. We were looking for those untold stories of these family-owned, family-run properties. So then after that initial online research, I would drive around and go meet with the owners, look at the properties. It's not designed to be a guidebook. I mean, it's history, it's stories. I find some of the stories to be inspirational, quite mm-hmm, frankly. Mm-hmm. Just how these people got these properties going. But I knew people would use it as a guidebook, and so I wanted them to be nice, places that people would get good experiences at. You went through a vetting process, driving around, and to be perfectly frank, you do run into people out there who probably shouldn't be in the business.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
but some of them are so responsible to the environment around them, to the properties, to the guests, and they're just amazing people to meet.
Well, and again, it has such special significance for someone like me who has a link to resorts in the past. It's almost like a scratch and sniff book for me. I mean, I looked at it and I went, "Wow, I've been there," and I really hadn't been there, but philosophically, I had been there. You must have had people like me in mind, because it had, at the end, to have a feel to it.
Oh, absolutely. I was really leaning heavy on nostalgia. You see that when you open to the title page with all the old brochures. I really do believe that, I guess it goes back to that song, Cats in the Cradle. Boomers missed out on a lot of time with their kids, chasing the almighty dollar. And they're looking to recapture that time now. That's why family reunions have become such a big thing for resorts. And not in a manipulative fashion, but I really did want to encourage people to become involved in that nostalgia and those good old days, if you will, when people didn't have all the electronic gadgets and were a little more unplugged and able to spend that time doing simple things, whether it be fishing or just going out for a boat ride, sitting on the beach. So, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it had to have that feel. And I worked with a very talented design team that really grabbed hold of that vision and I think really turned the book into something beautiful.
That is nice. That's the voice of Neil Johnson. The book is Resorts of Wisconsin. I saw in the dedications that you have six kids, so you know of what you speak. Taking
your number seven on the way to Del Hill.
Well, there you go. You've been spending a lot of time at resorts, I see.
That's right.
That's good.
That's right. Well, we've got four birthdays right around the same time, so my wife has told me that I can no longer touch her in June.
Ah, well, that's good, yeah. Interestingly enough, too, at the end of the book, you did kind of a summation, and I guess I never thought of the word resort, but then you guys talked about it at one time was considered a verb, you resort to something, but then I thought it also is kind of a contraction because you're going to resort.
Yeah.
And you're going to resort your life.
That's a good point.
It was fun to note that you did a lot of the book in a coffee shop because you had a house being built.
Yes. Yes, we're still working on that house. It's off grid where we bought what was an old Boy Scout camp.
Oh, boy.
Camp Washington. And I actually, the craziest thing, just this last week, I purchased through eBay one of the old patches, that old Boy Scout camp patch.
Cool.
Of Camp Washington, so we can honor that history. But yeah, you know, we're 1.33 miles off the grid.
Sounds like you're living the life there, pal.
Oh, yeah.
So now, one very important topic. Let's end with this. The burning question, what's the future of classic resorts? I mean, I'm wondering if younger generations are choosing to carry on the traditions, and if they do so, do they feel the legacy? Are they doomed? What's going on?
I have a natural sense of nostalgia, so I want it to work out.
Yeah, me too.
I really do. But the only way that's going to work out is if people support those family-owned, family-run properties. So we are at a time, baby boomers are at their, if you look at the demographics, they're at their peak spending on leisure travel. So right now, even through the difficult economic times, the resorts are holding their own.
Mm-hmm.
But the question is, does the next generation pick that mantle up and keep bringing their kids back? And after interviewing a lot of guests, resort owners, talking to them about it, I really believe that they will continue on. Now, I did meet plenty of resort owners who are on their way out because they don't believe that. But, you know, that becomes its own self-fulfilling prophecy, too, because you don't market then, you don't upkeep. It changes everything when you have that belief structure. But the ones that I'm talking to in the book, the ones that I wrote about, they're doing okay.
It fits very well into the very strong hunch that I've had for a number of years that we will enjoy things if we only expose ourselves to them. The younger generation may roll their eyes. I keep thinking of the movie On Golden Pond when that young kid went up there and he was just going, oh, Jesus, this is going to be a lot of fun. And it turned out to be, you know, the summer of his life. I contend that young people and families, if they gave themselves the opportunity to sit on the front porch after dinner and shoot the breeze and wave at the neighbors, or in this case, take the opportunity to go someplace and slow down and literally put all that activity and busyness behind them, they would love it and they would do it over and over and over again. Someone just needs to have the wherewithal to say, we're doing this.
Someone needs to lead, really what it comes down to. I mean, you know, talk about leadership in corporate America. I mean, I think that there's at times a lack of leadership within families, and mm-hmm. somebody really needs to grab the reins and take that lead and make it happen.
Let's do this again, Dad.
Best time of my life.
No kidding. Neil Johnson, great book. Thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you, Al.
Resorts of Wisconsin, exploring the heritage and history of Wisconsin's family resorts. Much more than just a trip back, and can be a wonderful trip forward for your family. I recommend it. It's available at resortsofwisconsin.com, also at Barnes & Noble. This weekend in Madison, Neil's appearing at the Lake Home and Cabin Show at the Alliant Energy Center. Has a booth. He'll be speaking as well. Kind of like this topic. Hope you did too. You like haggis? Tomorrow night's that big celebrating the haggis thing up at the Northern Lakes Center for the Arts in Amory. Eww. Thanks to Grace Fair for being there with promotional support this week. Gracias, Mr. Oliver, as always. The Art Crawl, Jean Gotte, Capoeira, Brazilian Energy next week, Fiber Arts. Can men and women be just friends? We'll hear about the research on Spectrum West next Friday at 5. I'm Al Ross. Have a great weekend. See you then.
Renowned for his art of emphatic form and vibrant color, Ellsworth Kelly has been recognized as a leading American painter and sculptor. The Madison Museum of Contemporary Art will host a major retrospective of Kelly's achievements in printmaking from January 19th through April 28th, 2013, in the main galleries at Momoka. For more information about